From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right.
On today's Fresh Air, we remember Sam Phillips, one of the most important behind-the-scenes figures in the history of rock and roll. He died yesterday at the age of 80. Phillips discovered Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Roy Orbison, and recorded them on his label, Sun Records. We'll listen back to a 1997 interview with Phillips, and we'll talk about his place in music history with Peter Guralnick, author of a 2-volume biography of Elvis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
That's all right, Mama, anyway, do.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. A U.S. soldier was killed today when an armored personnel carrier hit a landmine on a stretch of road leading to the Baghdad airport. 3 other soldiers were injured. The head of U.S. forces in Iraq says soldiers are coming up against increasingly sophisticated explosive devices. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from Baghdad.
Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez said the U.S. continues to fight a low-intensity conflict in parts of Iraq, mainly in Baghdad and the Sunni Triangle west and north of the city. The commander of U.S. ground forces here said the tactical sophistication of the ambushes are still basic hit-and-run attacks, but Sanchez said they are seeing more advanced explosive devices and techniques.
Are there timers being put on it, improvised explosives? Are there trip wires being used? The enemy is increasing the sophistication of those explosive devices, and they're using all types of ammunition.
Ammunition ranging from plastic explosives to mortars rigged to go off by remote control. In the last 2 weeks alone, attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq have killed 19 soldiers. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Baghdad.
West African leaders meeting in Ghana to discuss the civil unrest in Liberia say they'll deploy a peacekeeping force by Monday. Meanwhile, the arrival of a small forward party in preparation for the larger force has brought change to the streets of the capital city, Monrovia. The BBC's Paul Welsh reports.
The forward party of peacekeepers aren't armed and are simply making plans, but their arrival seems to have made a huge change here. Tens of thousands have been out on the streets, which have been all but deserted for days. The mortaring of the city appears to have stopped, and fighting has lessened. The officers are supposed to be leaving on Saturday, but the people are asking them to stay until a peacekeeping force arrives. They're afraid things will worsen in the gap. Heads of state from the region have been meeting to discuss that deployment. The executive secretary of the Organization of West African States says 1,500 peacekeepers will be here by Monday, and that President Charles Taylor has promised to leave the country 3 days after they land.
The BBC's Paul Welsh in Monrovia, Liberia. The State Department says North Korea has indicated it may be ready for 6-way talks on its alleged nuclear weapons program. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says that would be a positive development.
At this moment, we have indications that we find very encouraging. We have had conversations with the Chinese, but there continue to be conversations with the Chinese. We are prepared to go to multilateral talks.
Thank you.
And we have indications now that the North Koreans may be as well.
Until now, North Korea has insisted on direct talks with the United States to break the 9-month impasse over its nuclear ambitions. Today on Wall Street, the Dow Industrials finished up about 34 points at 92.33 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 14 and the S&P 500 up 3. This is NPR News. Retired Admiral John Poindexter is preparing to resign his job at the Pentagon's Defense Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, amid controversy over a research project that included a type of futures market on political violence. The plan would have let traders profit by correctly predicting assassinations and terrorist attacks in the Mideast. The plan was disclosed Monday by 2 Democratic senators, and criticism steadily increased. Government programs have helped reduce the number of children without health insurance, according to a new study, but state financial problems could threaten those gains. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
7.8 million children were uninsured in 2002, according to the study by the Urban Institute. That was down 1.8 million from the number in 1999, largely due to enrollment increases in Medicaid and the state children's health insurance program. At the same time, however, an estimated 4 million children were eligible for one or the other of the health programs for low-income families, but were not enrolled. and enrollment gains could well be replaced by enrollment losses, according to a second study released earlier this week. The Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured reported that between January 2002 and April 2003, four states reduced children's eligibility for health insurance. The reductions were part of broader efforts to address state budget shortfalls. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
A Los Angeles jury today declined to award damages to a man who claimed the nation's largest cigarette maker misled him with its advertising. The jury agreed with Frederick Reller that Philip Morris tobacco products caused his lung cancer, but it deadlocked on the issue of whether the tobacco giant fraudulently concealed the dangers of smoking. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from AARP, 35 million members dedicated to creating social change. AARP, the power to make it better. AARP.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our show today is devoted to Sam Phillips, one of the most important figures in the behind-the-scenes history of rock and roll. He died yesterday of respiratory failure at the age of 80. Phillips discovered and was the first to record Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Charlie Rich. He recorded them on his Memphis-based record label, Sun Records, which he founded in 1952. In a few minutes, we'll hear a 1997 interview with Phillips. Earlier today, we called the music writer Peter Guralnick, who wrote a two-volume history of Elvis Presley and produced a documentary about Phillips. How would you describe the sound that he created with his record label, Sun Records?
I think the sound that Sam aimed at was something that was loose, spontaneous, free. I mean, Sam prided himself as an audio engineer, and he was very, very particular about microphone placement in particular. But what he was most concerned with was creating an atmosphere in the studio that allowed the artist to relax and to offer up his or her very best contribution. He recognized from the outset that this was an unnatural process to put somebody in front of a microphone, somebody who probably at most had sung for his or her own family at home, maybe had sung, you know, on a stage, on a local stage for friends. But the idea of actually commemorating this, of creating a sound that might last an eternity, was something that could immediately put people off. And Sam's entire emphasis was to create an atmosphere in which not only was the person doing the recording, did the person feel relaxed, but they felt as if they were going to have an experience that was going to be fun. Sam emphasized that above everything else. If it wasn't fun, it wasn't worth doing.
Was Sam Phillips a kind of odd mix of laid back and driven? Laid back in the sense that I know in the studio he really prized like relaxation and just, you know, being in the moment and having a kind of spontaneous sounding performance, and it sounded like he wasn't a high pressure guy in the studio. On the other hand, he really had to drive himself to start that label and to keep it going, and you've said he sacrificed a lot in order to be able to do it.
No, I think that's right. I think Sam was very much a mix of someone who, as Marion Keisker, his assistant at Sun Records, said, Sam was not a patient man, but he showed extraordinary patience in the studio. He was very much a driven man, and what drove him most of all was this sense of mission, this sense that what he was doing was enormously important, the sense that he wanted to communicate to the world, he wanted to communicate to the nation at large how great this African-American culture with which he had grown up, you know, on the farm in Alabama, in Memphis, on Beale Street, how much this had to offer. And he was determined to do it against all odds. And he said again and again, he said, I just would have been, if I hadn't done it, if I hadn't been willing to risk anything, to risk everything, I wouldn't have been worth anything because I believed in it so much. And so he went out and he did it. He went out and he believed so strongly in individuality and difference and in nonconformity and uniqueness. I mean, he spoke about Howlin' Wolf's voice, and he said, you know, it was so bad, it was the best voice I ever heard. And he meant that. You know, the two artists that he spoke of as admiring the most were Charlie Rich and Howlin' Wolf, and you couldn't find two more different artists in the world, but it was because they were expressing something so unique from within themselves. He was almost a prophet. He was a sort of a driven in that sense, and his prophecy was, wake up, America. You've got to wake up. Don't allow yourself to drift into a dream of conformity, into a dream of just doing what everybody wants you to do, of being becoming the prisoner of fame, of baubles, of fashion. Follow your own dream. Follow your own mind, he says. And if we don't do that, and if we don't wake up soon, then one of these days we're just going to wake up and we're going to be in prison and we're not even going to know it.
Was he an easy man to be comfortable around? Were you kind of like relaxed around him when you started to get to know him, or did it take a while before you felt comfortable and relaxed in his presence?
Sam prided himself on his unpredictability.
Uh-huh.
So I would say relaxing around Sam, I think after a while, he would say to me sometimes, he says, it took me a long time to get used to you. And I said, well, good, I'm glad you finally got used to me. I mean, I felt that we became good friends and we could speak, you know, we could certainly speak. Sam was always going to speak his mind, but, I felt that I could speak my mind in my own way. But, Sam could always throw you off, and he delighted, in a sense, in not being predictable himself and not allowing you to get too comfortable around him. But at the same time, he was a person who could show tremendous affection and who could show tremendous support for those he really cared about.
What's one of the most unpredictable things he did or said in your presence?
Oh, boy, I don't know. being with Sam, it was always a wonderful ride. You know, you might be there with somebody might show up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and Sam would say, "Now, do you think you're good enough for her?" Now, I don't know about this, you know. He said, "What have you got to offer her? I know her, and she is really, you know, she's a fine woman." And, you know, so, I mean, he didn't really care. You know, it was like when he went on David Letterman, and he felt that, I mean, this was a source of great shame to many Memphians, because people felt that he had disgraced himself. But he went on David Letterman, and he didn't like the line of question. And whether Sam had had a few drinks or not, it had really had nothing to do with it. He was going to say exactly what he felt like saying. And when Letterman, he felt he was being patronized, I think, by Letterman. And just at some point, he just turned to Letterman and he says quizzically, he says, "David, did anyone ever tell you you should have your teeth fixed?" And the end of that show was, Letterman saying, "Say goodnight, Sam," and David, and Sam being ushered off the show. But I saw him with Rufus Thomas maybe a week or two later, and Rufus was asking him how he could get booked onto the Letterman show. And I sort of started laughing, thinking that Sam took a negative view of the experience. But Sam just said, "Rufus," he says, "those people on the Letterman show were some of the nicest people I've ever met. I mean, let me tell you, you know, they treated me like a prince." And then he's giving Rufus names, and he was perfectly serious about that too. I guess the greatest moment was when he got booed off the stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think it was the second year it was going, and he got up there and he was giving this speech about, I think he was inducting Carl Perkins. I don't know who he was inducting. He was inducting somebody. But he got off on the fact that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should be in Memphis. And he said, "Now listen, those people in Cleveland, they're some of the finest people I know. I mean, Cleveland, it's a wonderful city. Now don't make any mistake about this. I'm not putting down Cleveland, but the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should be in Memphis." Meanwhile, all the Cleveland people were there, and he was booed and just, you know, hissed off the stage. But again, he just didn't care. He was determined to express himself.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to. I'm always glad to talk to you.
Peter Guralnick is the author of a 2-volume biography of Elvis Presley. Coming up, we hear my 1997 interview with Sam Phillips. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering Sam Phillips. He died yesterday at the age of 80. He discovered and was the first to record Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, Carl Perkins, and Charlie Rich. We're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with Phillips in 1997. We started with one of the early recordings Phillips produced, the 1951 record many critics consider the first rock and roll record, Rocket 88, featuring singer Jackie Branson with Ike Turner at the piano.
You've heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Part of your genius has been finding musicians who brought together black music and country music, creating rock and roll and rockabilly. I'm wondering how you were exposed to black music as a white man growing up in the segregated South.
My interest in black music started at a very early age. I worked with black people in the fields. My daddy was a farmer. And he grew cotton, and of course cotton had to be picked and hoed. And my father, incidentally, did not own the farm. He was a tenant farmer, and he in turn would bring other people onto the farm to help them. So we were able to be together an awful lot with black people because of the closeness of the type of work that we had to do on the farms.
You started your producing career recording blues musicians and leasing the records to companies like RPM, Modern, and Chess Records. You recorded Howlin' Wolf, Walter Horton, Bobby Bland, Little Junior Parker, B.B. King, the very start of their careers. I'm wondering what it was like for you as a white man in the South in the late 40s and early 50s to be recording black musicians. Was it ever difficult to have rapport? I'm wondering if they saw you as the man because you were recording them and because you were white.
It was a type of thing that I think most black people had some doubt as to what, quote-unquote, we were up to early on. Because in many instances, black people were taken advantage of, and maybe when they thought something was for free or for a certain price, it didn't turn out that way. I knew that the black people that I was going to record, most of which had never seen even microphones, let alone a little studio, that the psychology that would be employed by me to have them feel comfortable and to do the thing that they felt they wanted to do in the way of music, rather than to try to please or do the type of thing that a white man might want to do, have them do, because I was not looking for Duke Ellington or Count Basie or Nat King Cole or any of the outstanding black jazz and pop musicians. I was looking to try to obtain from them a natural thing that they felt and wanted to do. The people that I was recording were people that had, to a great extent, the feel for the things they had experienced and they loved, and the way they spoke was to the people was through their music.
What was your approach to making musicians comfortable so that they would be themselves in the studio and not try to be somebody else or not try to do something just to please the producer? How would you get them to be themselves?
It varied with each one, of course, because the minute you had or tried to be non-condescending toward them, they would pick it up immediately. It would vary with the individual. Believe me, black people never missed anything when they were dealing with you. you might think they were abstract and really did not care that much about hearing what you had to say, but they truly did. And so psychology has always been, and I've never had one formal lesson in it, but I had a whole life of dealing with people, black and white, that were of meager means, and some of them were not as fortunate as even I. But I really did not have a real difficult time in communicating what I believe the necessary ingredients for them to relax and to do what they really, truly wanted to do, the type of thing.
One of the great blues musicians that you discovered and first recorded was Howlin' Wolf. And I want to play the recording that you produced of him doing Moonin' at Midnight in 1951. And this was something that you did for Chess Records. I think it made it to number 10 on the R&B charts. Tell us about your first encounter with Howlin' Wolf.
The Wolf, as I've said so many times, is one of my favorite artists. He was so individual in the things that he did. He had, number one, a voice that was so distinctive that nobody could mistake it for anybody else. That intrigued me. It was so absolutely untrained in so many ways, but at the same time, it was so honest that it was just, it brought about a certain passion just by listening to him to sing. And there was one thing about the Wolf that you never had to worry about. When he opened his mouth in a recording studio, and he would talk real low when he was talking to you. And he's a big man, about 6'4", and weighed probably 225 or 30 pounds, and nothing but muscle. But when he talked to you, you could barely hear him. When he sang to you, you hardly needed a microphone or an amplifier. But more than that, though, I think that his ability to get lost in a song for 2 or 3 minutes or ever how long the song was certainly as good as anybody I ever recorded. And when I say get lost in a song, I simply do mean that. And I think that is a good, unsophisticated term of saying that we all tried to get lost in what we were doing. And I think that was part of our success.
Well, let me play this 1951 Howlin' Wolf record that you produced, Moonin'.
I'm anxious to hear that, one of my favorite records.
Well, somebody calling me on my telephone.
That's Howlin' Wolf, a recording produced in 1951 by my guest, Sam Phillips. Sam Phillips, you started Sun Records, your studio in Memphis, after recording for independent companies, other people's independent companies like Chess Records. Why did you want to start your own studio? Did you have a vision of what you wanted to do in your own studio?
I actually never wanted to actually form a label as such, like Sun Records. I wanted to be strictly on the creative end of it because I believe so strongly in what I believed in, and I wanted to prove to myself one way or the other that what I had felt apparently for an awfully long time, was either something that was worthwhile, or that the public, if it had the chance, would tell us that, you know, you're on the wrong track. But I guess that after dealing with RPM and Modern Records and Chess, I guess I was disappointed in the way that I thought business was done. And I don't like to speak disparagingly of people, because these people were my friends. But I had some difficulty and, you know, working with them from a standpoint of what I felt was fair and equitable in the things that we had agreed on.
You started Sun Records after you had a nervous breakdown and even got electroshock therapy. I'm wondering if the two were related. If after the nervous breakdown you decided you had to be in business for yourself and do your own thing.
Well, I had worked hard, as many people had, all my life. I really did not know what, you know, the hands on the clock were for sure. And I don't know that that was smart, but anyway, that's the way I felt about it. I was totally and completely consumed in a way that I thought and still think was healthy. It was just that I was asking too much of my body to look after my deaf-mute aunt and my older mother and two young children, Knox and Jerry, the two, and my wife, Becky. I just had taken upon myself just more than I could handle for many, many years. And so with the pressures of trying to keep the doors open, to try to prove one way or the other about music and what could be done with it, I just overworked myself, and I had to go take electric shock treatments, and that is a horrifying experience, except, by golly, it did the thing for me. I came back stronger than ever. I do say, and I really truly believe this, that there's very few things that, and I think this is one of the reasons that we had so much success and what we did in music, is that so many people, although they may not have had electric shock, they went through some awfully hard times. And to have the opportunity to make a record and to participate in music and to be given that opportunity that they thought they'd never have, that had an awful lot to do with us being able to do what we ultimately wound up doing, which did affect the whole world.
We'll hear more of our 1997 interview with Sam Phillips in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, I heard the news. That's good to rockin' tonight. Well, I heard the news. That's good to rockin' tonight.
Coming up, Sam Phillips talks about discovering Elvis Presley as we continue our 1997 interview. Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records, died yesterday at the age of 80.
I say, oh, meet me in a hurry behind the barn. Don't you be afraid, I'll do you no harm. I want you to bring along my rocking shoes, cause tonight I'm going to rock away all my blues. I heard the news, there's good to rockin' tonight.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're remembering Sam Phillips, who died yesterday of respiratory failure at the age of 80. Phillips founded the Memphis-based record label Sun Records in 1952. He discovered and was the first to record Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, and Charlie Rich. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Sam Phillips. When Elvis first auditioned for you, I know that he sang in styles of his favorite performers, from, you know, white and black, from Lonnie Johnson to Dean Martin. What did you do to try to get a sense from Elvis of who Elvis really was, of what his kind of own voice was?
Well, Elvis being as young as he was, and of course I'm 12 years and 3 days older than Elvis, and he's 19, I guess I was 31 or whatever. But I can tell you, the only time that we possibly had what you might say a difference of opinion in what we were doing is that I really did not want to do some of the quote-unquote more popish things that Elvis truly did like, because Elvis, let's face it, had an absolute beautiful voice from the beginning. Trained or not, it was beautiful. But at the same time, he also had a certain intrigue about his voice, and I knew that, and I knew that we needed to feel our way around between great gut bucket blues and country. I really, truly thought that. And so I think Elvis, if he had had his way, and he absolutely gave us no problem at all on it, maybe he wouldn't have put a country-type thing on the backside of each R&B record that we put out on him, or each quote-unquote black-oriented record. But I thought that was a thing to do at the time.
Do you have a favorite of the Elvis Sun Sessions that...
I really do, and I really do, and it. I've kidded about it a lot because I wrote the song. I really didn't. It was the song "Mystery Train" that Little Junior Parker really basically wrote it, and we did it by him on Sun, and we did it in an entirely different tempo and approach, and he had the idea for the song and came in, and it wasn't quite like we thought it should be, and so I worked with him a little bit because I really did love the idea of the song. And so when we decided to do it on Elvis, it is something that I think that we did so entirely different. Although Little Junior Parker's record was Elvis's favorite of the two, I have to say that both of them were my favorites, and I till this day I'd have to say Mystery Train ranks way up there. But anyway, on the records that I did on Elvis, I mean, I really did like all the things I did on him. I really did. Now, you know, hey, I'm trying not to be partial at all.
Okay.
But, I mean, I really am because, I mean, I just liked what we did. Everything from Your Heartbreaker. Now, that is absolutely the most nothing record in the world, except that it is something.
Why don't we hear, since you produced Junior Parker's version of Mystery Train tune, why don't we hear both the Junior Parker and the Elvis version back to back?
We're in for a treat.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train, train, coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. No, not again. Train, train.
This Junior Parker and Elvis Presley, both of their versions of Mystery Train, both versions produced by my guest, Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. You know, I have to ask you this. People are always saying that you used to say, before you discovered Elvis, that you used to say, if I could find a white man who had the Negro sound and the Negro feel, or if I could find a white man who could sing like a black man, I could make $1 million or $1 billion. Did you really say that? And if so, what did you mean?
In essence, I did. And I simply meant that there was no feel better than the feel of black people and their rhythm. I still, till this day, feel that that is a true statement, regardless of the cultures that have changed to a great degree in many instances and just a slight degree in others. I just felt like that black music at that time did not have. You have to keep in mind, radio was the big deal then, before TV, and there was no way at that time. We got to go back, transpose ourselves 40-something years here, and realize that to get black artists played, it was very, very difficult because it wasn't that many stations on the air that were going to play black records. And I thought if we got a white person and people knew that he was a white person, that there was a good possibility that we could broaden the base for both black and white people that had talent. And that was my main reason for wanting to do that and making that statement.
A lot of listeners have spent a lot of time over the years wondering, how would music history have been different? How would Elvis have been different if you never sold his contract to RCA? I wonder if you lose a lot of sleep thinking about that, if you spend a lot of time thinking about that yourself.
I have not lost one wink of sleep about it. I did give Elvis advice that he really should produce his records when he left Sun, because Elvis had an excellent ear. Corporate vice presidents of big major labels, I don't think at all, were into the idea of let's find something that truly is new and different. I'm taking nothing away from them personally, but that was just a fact of life. I knew that there were a lot of things that RCA put out on Elvis due to a lot of the motion pictures and everything that he was making that really weren't the best material in the world for Elvis to do. If I had had Elvis right on up until the day he died, I couldn't have kept Elvis ultimately from being a tremendous force in music and influence on people, even if I had tried. I do not regret whatsoever any of the things that took place between the time I sold Elvis and all of this that we have even today. And you say, well, you mean all of that money and that total effect that has been had around the world? I feel like I was absolutely a part of that. And I don't care anything about claiming any credit for it, but I was a part of it because I recognized that Elvis Presley was unique, as I did so many, many other people that had no opportunity whatsoever.
We're listening back to a 1997 interview with Sam Phillips. He died yesterday at the age of 80. We'll continue the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. He discovered Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Roy Orbison. Phillips died yesterday at the age of 80. When artists like Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis were getting played on the radio, and it was just scandalous to a lot of people. You know, the kind of the power and the sexuality of the music terrified a lot of adults, PTAs, church groups. What did you make of all of the fuss about early rock and roll, a lot of which you were responsible for? I mean, did you think it was funny? Did you think it was scary? What did it mean to you?
No, I really did not think it was funny. I really seriously considered the fact that I knew that this was going to happen. People truly believed, a lot of people, you can call them hypocrites or whatever, but I can understand they thought that this was absolutely going to be the end of the world. And I saw it and I felt it, but I, at the same time, I thought this is just really one of the things that we will have to endure in order to find out whether or not what we feel about it is right. And if it's not right, then all they say is not going to kill it. If it is right, it will make it.
Were you attacked personally in any way?
Not personally, no. I was, I mean, physically, but personally, oh, yeah, my name was called quite frequently across the country, and especially in churches. And I'm a good old Southern Baptist and whatever that is, but I you know, that really, really, not that I wasn't cognizant of the people's real concern about this, but they had forgotten that the toughest time in a person's life, and I think any psychologist in this world will tell you this, is during the teenage years of anybody's existence. And teenagers did not have, before rock and roll and rhythm and blues, they did not have any type of music they could call their own once they got over 4 or 5 years old, until they were well into their 20s and were considered adults. So I just felt that this was a vast field that had been overlooked by just about everybody, and that if we had a white person that they could justify maybe a little bit to their parents that, well, you know, it's a white boy or whatever, maybe the actual feeling of resentment might not be quite as steeped in the racial aspects of it.
You gave up recording in about 1963. You gave up producing records. Why did you stop?
I think that the reason being is that I've always believed in younger people coming along and taking over. It became very difficult for independent labels to make it because at that time the major labels found out that we weren't just going to fold our tent and go away. When we started out, they thought, well, this is a passing fancy, and the chances are they won't be around long, so we'll get back to our regular curricular activities. So, I saw the handwriting on the wall. When you would do what you did, had to do, and your distributors had to work with you, and then the major labels would come along and offer contracts that we couldn't even think about, guarantees, because we were still very, very limited on funds. And so it was no use in me being a farm club, so to speak, for the major league club. And that's exactly what it came to be. So I decided, and I was not going to work because I was offered a job with RCA by Steve Scholes to go to RCA at the time I sold Elvis's contract. And I did not go because, number one, I knew I would not be of any value to RCA because I had to do whatever I did, be it right or wrong. I had to do it, quote unquote, the way that I felt I had to do it, in the way that I felt was necessary to prove what I had set out to prove. I knew that that wasn't necessarily going to work well with a big company, and it would be absolutely no percentage. It'd be only frustration. I would accomplish absolutely nothing.
You must have, or I would imagine that you must have really missed recording people when you stopped and missed discovering people.
I'll always miss it. I sure will. I you let me hear. I bought every old record I reckon Time Life put out on CD to go back and just to hear. Do you know, I go back right now, and I hear Summit Ridge Drive by Artie Shaw. Now that, you can hear absolutely some of the greatest rhythm, and this was cut in the 40s or late 30s. And you know, I mean, music is not an option, really, with people. We take it for granted, people that are in it professionally, people that just love it to listen to, and people that can take it or leave it. But music is the single most important element outside of, I guess, we need a little oxygen to breathe in order to be able to listen to music. But there is nothing on the face of God's earth that gives us more solace in more different areas and more different ways than music. And you better believe that if I could stay around here another 74 years and I could start all over again and have my way with a major company, or I would be recording people, because there is nothing in this world that is more rewarding, whether you got a dollar out of it or not, than working with, I mean, absolutely untried, unproven talent and seeing it come to the forefront and entertain, I mean, even the hardest-eared control man in the world behind that glass.
Did you ever wish that you were the performer and you weren't behind the glass in the control room, but you were in front of the microphone,
never,
in front of the crowd?
Never, never, never. And that's a good question. That's probably one of the better ones, Terry, because that's another thing. I was never, ever jealous. I was a pretty good musician. I've always said I wasn't worth a damn, but my bandmaster and everything at Coffee High School said I was good. I directed a band in the summer and this sort of thing. But no, that did not enter my mind. Mine was strictly the laboratory, and that's where I was happy. Oh, it'd have been great to go out and had a little fun with a horn. I played the tuba and played the drums, and I played the sousaphone and that sort of thing. But no, no. Listen, I had the good job. I had the good job. The boys out there on the floor, they had the tough job. They had to worry about one instrument. I had to worry about three, maybe, you know.
I think you just answered one of my questions. You said you played tuba when you were younger. You had said in one place that your favorite composer was John Philip Sousa. Now, I mean, I love marching band music. I love band music and marches and stuff. But I was really shocked to hear that from you, the man who discovered Elvis Presley, John Philip Sousa.
Hey, you've been reading my record or something, girl. Let me tell you something about John Philip Sousa. I heard this man, anybody that can take a 4-4 beat, like practically all martial music is,
mm-hmm.
and you take it and you have it stiff, quote-unquote stiff. I mean, and I'm not talking about marching as such, stiff-legged, but you take what martial music is what I call stiff music. This man absolutely got more melody chords. I'm not talking about necessarily harmony chords, because, let's face it, martial music is not made up just for a nice big blend of harmony. But you listen to this guy and the way that he handled it. This guy is a master at crafting music that if you can make people want to listen to it, And if you can make somebody want to listen to a good martial piece of music like the Washington Post March or a Symphony Fidelis and enjoy it, I mean, I'm going to tell you, you are a master musician. He is the best at what he did. There's not a good second. You can't name one. I would say probably some of the greatest directors in the world. And, of course, the Boston Pops has always been one of my favorite. That Fiedler was so crazy. I loved him, man. He was scared of nothing, absolutely scared of nothing. The criticism, he didn't give a damn. Give him a drink before he went out on stage, a half a pint. And you can forget it, honey. You were going to have fun with music. And boy, did he help to separate the lines of demarcation in music and social affairs and all. I mean, you know, you don't don't get me started.
No, wait. You mentioned that he'd have a little drink before. My understanding is that you wouldn't let your musicians have a drink in the studio, with the exception of Howlin' Wolf.
That is right. Damn you, woman, I swear to God. Do you have my jail record up there, too? But honestly, that's a fact. And the Wolf, I looked at him as big as he was, and then a half of a pint of Thunderbird wine, and actually that half pint was half gone already, and I said, you know, there can't be too much harm done if I permit him to break the rules around here. And besides that, if he stepped on me, I might be no more.
Now, what about other people? Why wouldn't you let them drink? Because after all, you wanted them to be as relaxed and as natural and uninhibited as they could.
I don't really know. I really honestly don't know, Terry. There was just something I wanted to really get high on what we were attempting to do. And the one thing that I can tell you unequivocally again is that we did get high on our music. Even the cuts that we didn't feel that we had it on, we got high on it. And I want to tell you, there is no high in this world better than when you cut something that you didn't believe that you could do. You maybe said to yourself, I know I can do it, but you really didn't believe you could do it, and you do it. Now, you tell me something that would be more potentially high. Now, that's high-octane stuff, so far as I'm concerned.
We're listening back to a 1997 interview with Sam Phillips. He died yesterday at the age of 80. We'll continue the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I wanna play out with you. Hit it! Understand. I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man. And then, baby, come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, come. Come back, baby, I won't play out with you. Oh, baby, 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 baby. Come back, baby.
Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records. He discovered Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, and Charlie Rich. Phillips died yesterday at the age of 80. Sam Phillips, one last thing. I want to end with one of the records you produced, and I'll ask you to choose a favorite for us to go out with, and if there's a story behind it, to tell us the story, if you can.
Well, let me do this. I want to tell you, one of my favorite artists of all time was a guy known as C. Rich to us. His name is Charlie Rich. And when you listen to No Headstone on My Grave, I want to tell you, you are listening to a masterpiece of what life is all about. And knowing that Charlie could do just about any type of thing in this world, in addition to writing some of the greatest songs you ever heard, I would say that to go out on No Headstone on My Grave would be really the highest, highest esteemed, biggest stone in the whole cemetery.
Don't put no headstone on my grave. All my life I've been a slave. I don't want the world to know. Here lies the man that loved you so. Don't send no flowers.
I'm gone. Just put me down and then move on. Just put me down and let me be free from all this misery. Mm-hmm. Tell my mother not to cry. I'll see her. Tell her that I'm finally free from the trouble you caused me. But don't put no headstone on my grave.
Charlie Rich, produced by Sam Phillips. Phillips died yesterday at the age of 80. We'll continue our tribute to him tomorrow, including excerpts of interviews with Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Johnny Cash's first record, Hey Porter, recorded in 1955, produced by Sam Phillips for his Sun record label.
Hey Porter, would you tell me the time? How much longer will it be till we cross that Mason-Dixon line? At daylight, would you tell that engineer to slow it down? Or better still, just stop the train, 'cause I want to look around. Hey Porter, what time did you say? How much longer will it be till I can see the light of day? When we hit Dixie, will you tell that engineer to ring his bell and ask everybody that ain't asleep to stand right up and yell? Hey Porter, it's getting light outside. This old train is puffing smoke and I have to strain my eyes. But ask that engineer if he will blow his whistle, please, 'cause I smell frost on cotton leaves and I feel that southern breeze. Hey Porter, please get my bags for me. I need nobody to tell me now that we're in Tennessee. Go tell that engineer to make that lonesome whistle scream. We're not so far from home, so take it easy on the steam.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Hunting Midnight, a historical mystery from Richard Zimler, the author of The Last Kabbalist of Lisbon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you...
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our tribute to Sam Phillips. We feature interviews with two of the people he discovered, Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash, and we talk about the history of Phillips' record label, Sun Records. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Slander my name all over the place and do anything that you want to do.